I say let's fucking do it. Hello, and welcome to the ADHD Deep Dive, the show that's not about ADHD, but is filled with proof it exists. My name is David J. Mund, and it is another car cast, Mund on the move. I am currently en route to Traverse City, which I feel like is where I'm usually headed when I do these podcasts, on the move. I have a full weekend of shooting music videos. I have a band that has hired me up north to shoot 3 music videos, so I'm going to get about 75% of the main video work done this weekend, and then we'll probably spend the next month or so gathering additional footage back home or elsewhere just to include as B-roll as part of the footage. So it is a busy weekend. I'm going to be staying with Nikolai, aka Lifer Visuals. A link in the description. He's the guy who made the short film Penelope with me, which if you have not seen, please go check that out on the David J. Mund YouTube channel. Let's see. There's definitely a primary topic of conversation this week. But before I do that, I feel like I should get a few things out of the way. Let's do the plugs up front this time, yeah? So first and foremost being, I don't exactly know what I'm doing with it yet. I still don't, other than releasing podcast episodes a day early on the Patreon. There it is. I have a Patreon. If you are interested in becoming a member, minimum membership is just one single dollar, I believe, billed monthly. So if you want to support what we're doing here at the ADHD Deep Dive or these creative endeavors going forward, this isn't my income I'm asking you for. I'm not asking for you to pay my bills. But what the Patreon will do, what the Patreon funds will do is go towards... A, you'll get some exclusive stuff. I don't know what that stuff will be. Also, man, it's going to be so dark back and forth on this video. I'm not 100% sure. Also, it's incredibly illegal what I'm doing here. I'm technically driving with one hand, but let me tell you, there's nobody near me. Actually, right there, I wasn't driving with any hands. I was driving with my kneecaps. So to the local police officers whose jurisdiction I am driving through right now, don't come after me. I think the statute of limitations has already passed once this video will have come out, so you can't arrest me. But also, I recognize that what I'm doing right now is incredibly illegal. So, I apologize. Main thing, Patreon exists. If you want to support what we're doing here on the ADHD Deep Dive, just go to patreon.com. I think it's /David J. Mund. Please check the link in the description to confirm that that is true. That's it for the Patreon. For music-related information... Midwest Skies has a show coming up in Grand Rapids on 420, #blazeit. We'll get to that in just a moment, because today's topic of conversation is pretty relevant to 420. But if you want to check us out in the Grand Rapids area, it is an all-day punk music festival. Plenty of good bands on this lineup that we have played with in the past, with names such as American Cheese, and who did we just play with a few weeks ago? Motion Sick. Other bands that I'm definitely forgetting, and I apologize. Main thing, if you want information on that, you want to come to that. I don't remember the fee to get in at the door, but you can get a discount. Just head to MidwestSkiesRock.com if you want a little bit of information on that. A, how to get tickets to the show, and B, how to get discounted tickets. And then the following week, April 27th, we will once again be live up in Kalkaska for Troutzilla Fest, for Obscurus DM Productions Troutzilla Fest. This is also a festival. This is a rock music festival, not necessarily a punk-specific festival. On the 20th, I believe we have a half-hour set. On the 27th, we have an hour-long set. For both of these shows, we are... I don't think James or Kyle is watching this anyway, so it's not going to be... It's not like they'll be upset that I've revealed this information, and I don't think it's particularly secret anyway. There's a song that I wrote about... It started with a riff I wrote maybe 10 years ago on guitar. And then I wrote lyrics to it about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, that we are finally in the process of mixing and mastering. TBD on the release date for that song, But if you want to hear it live, head to these shows. So, one last little bit of recap. Just for the upfront information, rather than putting this at the back of the podcast, if you want to become a member of the Patreon and support what we're doing here for just $1 a month, head to the link in the description to become a member, to become a patron. And then April 20th in Grand Rapids for the Punk Music Music Festival. And then the 27th in Kalkaska for the Rock Music Festival. Okay, you've probably seen the title. I think that I called it Off the Sauce. Let's get to some relative information. So what I was talking about with the 420 thing. Okay, so if you listened last week, you'll know that I had a bit of a medical, or maybe 2 weeks ago, you'll know that I had a bit of a medical brouhaha with my guts. I don't know that I'm really interested in providing a major update beyond I'm doing okay. I have not yet scheduled the colonoscopy. I don't know if my finances will even allow me to do such a thing, so TBD on if that's even happening. But when that event happened, I was already in the process of considering taking a tolerance break from weed. I spent about 3 or 4 days not smoking before caving in and hitting my pen. I think what initially started that kick was I bought a cartridge. No, here's what it was. Oh, yeah. I bought a cartridge, which costs, you know, maybe 12, 15 bucks, something like that. And then took a hit of it, got home, dropped it, and it shattered. So that was frustrating, whatever. So then I just turn around and I go back and I buy another one. I get home, I drop it, and it fucking shatters. Oh, man, that made me so mad at that point. And this is where sort of the, like, addict mentality kicks in, where I'm like, I just want my fix, man. I need the good shit. And I, in fact, did not have the good shit. And by the time that I had dropped it, I believe the store had already closed, so I wasn't going to go back and get another one. But at this point, I'd already spent $30 on a single cartridge that I got two hits out of. So I go back the next day, get the cartridge. I'm smoking it like normal. Then we play a show. I think it was the one that we had at the Pyramid Scheme in Grand Rapids. Midwest Guys has a show. And then during the process of transporting gear, I fucking lost my pen. And I had no idea where it went. And that enraged me to the point that I was like, I am so, like, I don't know, maybe tweaking isn't the right word, but I was getting so upset about the idea of not having weed on me that there was some small clarification in my brain that was like, well, maybe this is a good opportunity to take your first real legitimate tolerance break in over 2 years. If you followed the David J. Munn channel a few years ago, it's no longer on there now because I felt a little cringe about it, and it contains a lot of personal information. I was doing a lot of vlogs at the time. I probably shouldn't have been. I tried to re-explore the vlogs again. I used to do them a lot back in the day. But anyway, I made a series called Getting Out of the Weeds, which was me just getting off of weed. I think the goal was for a month. And then a week in, I caved. So then it ended up becoming, as a punishment for myself, which self-punishments really don't work in my world. It ended up becoming 2 months of sobriety from weed. I think I was still smoking CBD at the time because I really just wanted to, like, get the physical fix of smoking something. And I was, whatever, I think I was appreciating the value of keeping CBD in my life because whether it was placebo or not, I liked smoking and it felt like it did something for me and I didn't want to go to smoking cigarettes and I wasn't vaping at the time. I'm not vaping now, for clarity's sake. But anyway, I ended up picking up smoking weed and then from that point on, this was either late 2020 or early 2021. from that point on up until a few weeks ago, I'm almost positive that I had THC in my system in some capacity all day, every day, from that point until, like I said, a few weeks ago. Which means at that point, sure, was I getting high? Yeah, probably, technically. There's THC in my system, so it's definitely higher than what a sober baseline would be. But my baseline was high when I got high, or when I got quote-unquote stoned. I could get stoned if I smoked enough, but that would require smoking a fuckload. I wasn't really getting stoned anymore. So, like, the beauty of weed, especially when you, like, first start, or if you rarely do it, is that it is some type of experience. It's not like a trip if you don't smoke weed or never have smoked weed. I don't feel like it's necessary to explain what it is that weed does for a person's body. But it is certainly more of a mind-altering state when you don't do it all day, every day. So much so that it's, like, fun. It's a fun experience, and sometimes it can actually be a, like, healing experience in that, like, if you go in smoking weed with intention rather than just it being a vice that you use, it has significantly different effects. Regardless, that was not the case for me. I was smoking all day, every day, and more importantly, I was using my little pen, my vape pen, with the cartridges, and that is so freaking convenient that, like, just like anyone would go out and hit a breeze or smoke a cigarette, I was just popping out real fast, hitting the pen. You don't smell like weed if you're just smoking that. And so I kind of gave up on smoking flower because the pens, not only is flower, I mean, it's been a while, I guess, since I've bought flower, but, like, let's say the average is like 20 to 25% THC these days. I imagine it probably is, because back in the day when I was smoking bush weed, it was like, you were excited if it got up to 20% because that was like, what? That's insane crystals. Regardless, the cartridges that I've been vaping on, that I've been smoking on, are like nearing 90 to 95% THC. So, like, whatever. Main point is cartridges technically get you higher than flower. So what's the point in buying flower when I can just smoke the freaking cartridges all day, every day? So this happens, right? Everything that I just told you, I lost the cartridge, I lost the pen, whatever. And then I decide, you know what, this is a good time to take a small tolerance break. So day one and day two go by without smoking weed. And let me tell you, folks, again, this is more relevant to the people who never have or don't smoke weed often. If you do smoke weed often and have done this type of thing, you might know, especially if you're an all-day, everyday smoker. There are withdrawal symptoms from smoking weed, not just the irritability of, like, you know, like the oral fixation of, like, having something to be smoking or having something in your mouth or, like, the act of smoking. And not just the irritation of, like, I don't know, whatever. Like, if you're just re-entering a sober mind, getting back in touch with what your sober self is, an unaltered state, you know, there's a lot of irritability that comes with that. But the worst of it is, for me, just the worst, like, hot flashes. Get real hot, like, get real sweaty, especially if you, like, wake up in the middle of the night, just, like, yeah, just whatever, yeah, so sweaty. It's kind of gross. I mean, you're purging a bunch of shit from your system. Your body is desperately aching for that good kush, and you're just not getting it. So day three came around, and I was like, I could do this. I just got to get, like, past one or two more days. And then I happened to be with a friend who was smoking, and I was weak. I hit their pen, and then at that point I was like, ooh, I should go buy a new pen, get a new cartridge. So I picked up the pen and the cartridge. So I think, yeah, the pen, maybe $20. Let's say it cost me $40, regardless. I ended up picking up stuff again. And then I smoked for like 3 or 4 days, got that weed back in my system, returned to my high baseline. And then that's when all that medical shit happened from the last episode, which again, if you have not listened, go ahead and check that out. I think it was called, TMI, and then in parentheses, too much inflammation. If you missed that episode, feel free to check it out. Main point being, at that point, I was like, well, now I'm like trying to figure out what's going on with my body. So anything that alters this like baseline sobriety probably should be cut out for just a little bit anyway to see what's going on. So that meant I definitely wasn't drinking alcohol, which I don't really drink that much anyway. If I drink, I end up having like 1 or 2 drinks, maybe 3 drinks. And then if I'm really getting wild, I'll have 4 drinks, but I don't have it in me anymore to smoke, or sorry, to drink a bunch of alcohol. It's not my vice. I also don't like beer. So typically that ends up meaning I drink a lot of cider, which means I get a fuckload of sugar in my body. And if it's not cider, it ends up being whiskey, some whiskey type of drink. And then at that point, you know, you're rolling the dice with your sobriety anyway. You can only have so much liquor before you're not sober. And with the amount of shows that we do, it's a very easy way to slip into whatever, not full-blown alcoholism, although that certainly is what happens with a lot of artists, but just casual alcoholism or casual alcohol abuse. And I don't really have any interest or, you know, whatever I'm trying to say here. The main thing is I don't really want to drink. I'm not trying to substitute one vice for another in that way. So I wasn't drinking. And I wanted to, at least in some capacity, stay sober from weed. But then that means that I had that little first round of withdrawal, which meant, you know, I was starting to reach that horizon of withdrawal to the point where it's finally out of your system and behind you. And then I started smoking again. So then during all this stuff that I was dealing with medically, I was also having round 2 of withdrawals because I had smoked weed in between these times. So there was something that kind of clicked in my brain to tell me, like, you don't want to do this a third time in under 2 months. You don't want to go through this withdrawal shit within a third time in 2 months. And at this point, it had already been like 5 days or something like that. And now my dreams were starting to come back, which, again, this is maybe only relevant to a handful of people who never have or who don't often. And maybe this is still subjective regardless, because this is my own personal experience. Maybe other people who smoke weed don't have this issue. But during the entirety of the time that I have been smoking weed all day, every day, I don't dream anymore. Or rather, I don't remember my dreams. And while this audience is small, I don't know that it consists of a bunch of people who knew my relationship with my dreams in the past. But my dreams used to be everything to me. I've got books and books of dream journals, which maybe is relevant for a podcast on another day, or another topic of conversation for a podcast. But my dream recall used to be the most important thing to me. So much so that, like, I would wake myself up intentionally a few times in the middle of the night to log my dreams, to assess if I had had any dreams. And I used to be really proficient in lucid dreaming, not just lucid stage 1 in that, like, you recognize that you are dreaming within a dream, but my ability to control my dreams once becoming lucid used to be, whatever, maybe I'm throwing a bunch of fancy words for the hell of it, unparalleled. It used to be so, so important to me to at least 2 or 3 times within a given week. Also, it's starting to rain pretty hard now, so I'm sorry if the rain sounds get a little bit loud. But my dreams to me, And anyways, it used to be very important to me to have at least 1 or 2 lucid dreams within a given week. Given week. Sometimes I'd have multiple in a day, multiple in a night. But the ability to control your dream and stay asleep. Because what happens for a lot of people is they go like, oh shit, I'm dreaming. What? That's crazy. And then either they're still subject to the whims of their subconscious and they can't control it, but they're instead just aware that they're dreaming. Or what ends up happening, if you've seen the movie Inception, there is some truth to, at least again, just subjectively for me personally, is when you start to become aware that you're dreaming, everything and everyone in your dream starts to become aware that this is a dream. So like either things start to go sour real fast, or like you get so excited that you wake up from it. But I had been so seasoned in lucid dreaming that like sometimes I would like snap, realize that I'm dreaming, and then make a conscious decision to then wipe the slate clean, literally place myself in a completely blank, empty, white room, and then paint the scene I want to dream. So if there's things that I wanted to actually focus on in my life, you know, sometimes I would like choose to sit down and talk with myself across a table in an empty room, speak to my own subconscious. And that itself is a psychedelic experience. Coming back from one of those, having some sense of self-discovery or self-realization or just enjoyment of the fact that I did that was so worth it to me to be sober. But once, you know, for a while, weed was just a casual part of my life. It ended up becoming, yeah, again, an all-day, everyday part of my life, especially post-pandemic. But once the dreams started coming back, there was this like emotional realization for me that like I've not had a dream or remembered a dream in so long. And it was just so beautiful to reconnect with my subconscious in that way. My consciousness. My conscience. Whatever. Fucking come on, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it was so beautiful to me that I was like, let's just ride this out and see how long we can make it. And so right now I'm on, maybe 2.5 weeks, almost 3 weeks. I'm at least having a dream every single night. Oftentimes I'm not remembering it in full other than like a splash detail. And I do not have the discipline that I once had yet of immediately writing down that dream as soon as I have it or remember it, which is a big part of like what you kind of have to do if you want to get into lucid dreaming, is like the second you are back in your waking life state, you gotta like flip over and at least jot down, or some people do like talk to text notes or whatever. I found it more helpful for me to do like a kind of a Spark Notes version, at least a Spark Notes version of what my dream was, if not completely like every single detail I remembered in full paragraphs, as if I was just describing it to you here. So anyways, I don't have that discipline yet. I don't know if that's the goal right now. Right now I'm just kind of appreciating, like I said, just even having dreams again in the first place, remembering my dreams again in the first place. So 2.5 weeks in, it's been interesting. I've kicked the night sweats. I don't feel as though I'm having those withdrawal symptoms. The cravings are certainly there, in that like I live in a busy city, so I'm always smelling weed. I'm always seeing people smoking. I'm driving past 2 or 3 dispensaries in a given day. I miss it. And to be honest with you, to a degree, it kind of bums me out that, you know, some people, when they get sober, decide or are able to just shift from an all-day, everyday thing to treating it like a little treat or using it in moderation. What I have discovered throughout the course of my life is that I don't have the capacity for that right now, or at least yet. Somebody's driving up right next to me, and I always get afraid when I'm driving on the highway and I'm doing these podcasts that people will be like, what the hell is that guy doing? Is he holding a fuzzy butt plug up by his face? If you're only listening to the audio version, this has always kind of looked like a little fuzzy butt plug. But anyways, I don't want to say I don't have the ability, but maybe I don't. Maybe that's the ego getting to me, where like I feel as though I deserve to have the ability to use in moderation, but maybe I just don't have the ability to use it within moderately, like I do with alcohol. Like, some people crave alcohol and need it and go through these same withdrawal symptoms, but extremely. Like, my understanding is that alcohol withdrawal symptoms are way worse than what weed withdrawals are, which is kind of my justification for like smoking pot in the first place. Like, at least I'm not drinking. You know, I could be an alcoholic, but I think that's extremely dismissive of what people go through, what addicts go through all the time. But even more so, that point in and of itself, that word addict, just because I'm not an alcoholic doesn't mean I'm not an addict, you know? And if you don't smoke or drink, it doesn't mean you're not an addict either. I think one of my other addictions, which I do feel like I'm getting somewhat better at, except for when the sweets come in. Anyways, is binge eating. Binge eating is one of those huge addictions. Which now reminds me, now that I'm saying addictions, I put out a question to some viewers. So tell you what. I'm about to have to clip this video anyway because my camera only records for 30 minutes at a time. I need to get some food, so what I'm going to do is stop at Subway, probably. Stop, snag some food. And then I'm going to check out... I think I asked you guys what are some addictions that you struggle with. And I had a few responses. So I'll stop, I'll get the food, I'll talk about your addictions, and then I have one more sauce to discuss that I'm getting off of, because officially, for pretty much the exact same amount of time that I've been off of weed, I have officially weaned off of my anxiety medication, or my anti-anxiety medication. And that itself has been a huge process, a huge journey for me. So I will probably cut to an ad here, and I'll see you on the other side. All right, y'all. If you're watching the video version, see that skull? See this? This is not a punk house, it's a punk home banner. All of these things are available at catandcrew.com. That's right, they're the first sponsors. Catandcrew.com. Enter the promo code Monday, it's Monday, M-U-N-D-A-Y, to receive 10% off of your final purchase. You can get those koozies, you can get banners, you can get earrings, you can get coasters, you can get skull planters. I think it's really cool that they decided to give ADHD Deep Dive listeners an exclusive deal, because, you know, it's cool that we're building a little audience here and that you guys get to have some sort of special perks that nobody else gets. So if you aren't familiar with it yet, go to catandcrew.com, enter the promo code Monday, M-U-N-D-A-Y at checkout, get 10% off your final order. Okay, back to the show. Okay, so I ate my food in the parking lot. I had a veggie sub, for what it's worth, a little bit of avocado spread, some provolone cheese, some lettuce, spinach, green pepper, banana pepper, extra pickle, honey mustard with a little bit of salt and pepper, and a small little bag of Harvest Cheddar Sun Chips, in case you were curious. So anyways, I've consumed the food, and now we can resume. I was talking about the anxiety medication that I've been on. Here, let me quickly hit this thing real fast. I was talking about the anxiety medication that I was on, but I don't think it's really worthwhile for me to talk about it in any great detail, because I think I've been kind of slowly trickling it out over the last few weeks or months, just explaining that, like, here, I'll give you my soft pitch. Okay, just a small little shorter explanation for why it is that I'm getting off, or officially off, of the anxiety medication. So, and I'm going to hit you with some blunt truths if I haven't already mentioned them in the podcast. So, I think it was 2018, is when I first got on them. And I was on a drug called Lexapro. And the primary consequence, even though I'll be honest, I wasn't really like focused. I was 2018, I was fucking miserable, folks. Maybe there's still reasons for me to talk about it on a different podcast episode, but it's not super relevant for me to talk about it now. But anyways, during 2018, I was arguably the most miserable that I've ever been. So I got on that medication, but I think I was less anxious. Well, I certainly was anxious, but I was less about the anxiety and more about the depression. And I was put on Lexapro, which, again, for the blunt truth, quite frankly, made my penis stop working sexually in the bedroom. Whatever. It just, if you've been on it, it completely destroys your libido. Sorry for the TMI, but even when you're having sex, like, it kills the ability to have an orgasm. Wow! I'm totally fine talking about this stuff. I just feel bad for the people that are very close to me in my life that listen to that, that are hearing me talk about my penis. Anyways, main point, I got off of them, but at the time, I didn't take any advice from a doctor, I didn't do any research, and I just stopped taking them. Which pretty much directly was followed up by me then moving to New York, which very shortly thereafter was when I first considered suicide. Not first considered it, but when it was the most real to me. So I was going through cold turkey depression and anxiety medication withdrawals at a time that I was alone, and scared and broke. And in the middle of nowhere, not in the middle of nowhere, but in comparison to anyone I could ever know, anyone in my life, I'm just saying, it was a bad experience getting off of them. Then, 2020, I have to imagine it was June of 2020. It could have been much later or much earlier. I think it wasn't earlier than 2020. I know that it was either 2020 or 2021, but I'm almost positive that it was summer of 2020. I was having the most excruciating panic attacks that I've ever had. I think I probably was starting to identify with the feeling of anxiety. I think I was starting to understand what anxiety was versus depression, where in the past, maybe I just kind of conflated the two, or like I thought anxiety was stress or stress was anxiety or vice versa, whatever. I didn't understand. I knew anxiety was a word. I could say that I was anxious at any given moment, but I don't think I really knew what that meant. And this is when a little bit of therapy started coming into play. It became an important step for me to get on anxiety medication. Because, again, I think I only alluded to it, but I was having insane panic attacks that for a while I actually thought I was, like, having a heart attack. Like, when they would happen, debilitating chest pain, cold sweats. Then fused with me again, just being completely stoned out of my mind during 2020, because at this time I was smoking pretty much exclusively out of a bong all day. I'd get home, hit the bong 4 or 5 times, go out for a little while, come back, gotta hit the bong again. Whatever. At this point, I got on a generic for Cymbalta called duloxetine. And they start you on 20 milligrams. Then I think from there it went 30. And then 60. But then I was on 60 milligrams for the longest time. And then recently, maybe as long as 6 months ago, maybe a little bit longer, I recently had a conversation with my doctor kind of telling them that, well, a doctor that I had seen for the longest time, just to be clear, and if you heard the last episode, this is all familiar information to you. I don't have insurance, which means I don't have a primary physician. So I was just doing Zoom calls or whatever, telehealth, with my doctor from back home. And back home being up north. I haven't seen a doctor locally around here other than an ER physician. And anyways, I had the telehealth appointment because a few times this last year, just for whatever circumstance, maybe it was because we were out late in the band. I think honestly, probably that is where my habit of forgetting to take my medication came in, because usually we do not stay where we're playing. I know there are plans for that when we tour this summer, which I'll talk details about that later on. Probably not this episode. You've already heard about the shows that we're doing that I want you to come to. But what would happen is I wouldn't end up getting home until like 4 a.m. And what I usually do is take the medication at 10 p.m. When it first started, when I first was on it, I was taking them in the morning. But when you first get on medication like that, you really like actually feel side effects, which for me for a small little while was like a nausea, heightened anxiety. That's kind of something they don't really tell you about anxiety medication, although maybe they do in the commercials for them, but they list 400 other side effects, including death often. So anyways, it made more sense for me to take them at night because the side effects were kind of rough and I just didn't want to feel them during the day. It was just more worth it for me to take it, fall asleep, let whatever side effects were going to happen at night while I was asleep. I said I wasn't going to talk about this in great length, but it appears I'm talking about it in great length. And then on the flip side of that, there are consequences similar to the side effects of taking them, but certainly more severe. When you forget to take your anxiety medication, especially when it's at such a high dose. The next day is worse than it is so much worse of a feeling than not being on medication in general, that while you're going through that, it's kind of like, well, why would I ever be on this if the consequences of taking it are more severe? The consequences of forgetting to take it are more severe than even being on the medication in the first place, or than not being on the medication in the first place. And that kind of started to click with me, like, there, you know, let's say, God forbid, another pandemic happens, another supply chain happens, or a supply chain issues happen, you know, or some type of natural disaster or whatever. And then, like, suddenly I am without my medication and I can't take it. Well, then at that point, I am forced into a cold turkey quitting of it, which rather than just being on it for a few months like I was in the past and then cold turkeying it, I have been on it for, 3 years now, maybe 4 years. And so again, like whenever I forget to take it, the consequences were so severe that next day, heightened anxiety, facial numbness, extreme depression, and if not any of those feelings, more of a dissociative consequence in that, like, I can't feel anything. I can't bring myself to feel any emotion about anything. And that became so insufferable for me. Because honestly, over the last year, there were, you know, probably 10 times that I forgot to take it. Or it had been so late, like we don't get home until freaking 6 a.m. or something like that, that like me taking it, like I fear overdosing too, even though I totally understand that you don't really, even though I'm sure you could, you don't really overdose on anxiety medication if you happen to accidentally take two. You take it every single day, so your body will probably suss it out. But like that shit, fucking with medication is just scary to me. And it was not something I really wanted to do. So I began the conversation with my doctor about weaning myself down, because while I do certainly believe, and maybe I can even go so far as to say, I know that during that period of time that I was on it, that helped a lot. It helped my anxiety a lot. It helped bring me to a baseline. Now, just to be clear, if you are thinking about getting on anxiety medication, first of all, do not take this as legitimate advice. Consult with a physician. In addition to that, it's not the same for everyone. There was another greater point that I had to make. Let me think on it. What was I going to say? Welcome to the ADHD Deep Dive, the show that's not about ADHD, but is filled with proof it exists. See what I mean? Anyways, whatever. Let's just move on to this next point. I had gotten to a point where... Oh, yeah, right. It is not a catch-all solution. You don't just get on anxiety medication and then suddenly you don't have anxiety. It helps significantly with the panic or anxiety-induced panic attacks that I was having. I can't say that I've had a legitimate panic attack in a while. But again, with it being something that's not a catch-all, there is external work that you need to do. And I always get a little bit nervous that I will conflate the terms meditation and yoga because I do them simultaneously. I do meditation externally through yoga, and I do yoga where I'm sometimes not nearly as focused on my brain and more focused about the workout of it all. But those two combined become such a meditative process that in addition to, yeah, some therapy that I had at the time, which again, as much as I kind of wish I was back in therapy, I just don't have the funds or the insurance to do so. But in addition to the medication, I was doing therapy. I was getting back in shape. I was meditating. I was self-reflecting, working on breathing techniques outside of the medication to like help myself with my panic, with my anxiety, or with my panic attacks, my anxiety. There's a lot that has led up to this point for me to finally end up getting off of the medication, that it felt like it was time to, if there was ever a time to get off the medication, now was probably the time to see if it worked for me. So we went from 60 milligrams every single day to then 30 milligrams to then 20 milligrams, then 20 milligrams every other day to nothing. And for about a month now, maybe a little bit under that, I've been off of it. And the reason I know that I am not suffering from withdrawals, or the reason that I know that weaning it off has worked in a way that cutting cold turkey has not, is because I'm not suffering those withdrawal symptoms. I think at first, especially when I halved the dosage, when I went from 60 to 30, I felt it. I felt it big time. And that's just a weird reality that you exist in where you're like, I feel this way because I'm getting off of medication that is supposed to work. My body's used to getting a certain dosage. It's not getting that now. This is a withdrawal. And then when I went from 30 to 20, wasn't really anything. Then when I went from 20 to every other day, that's when I felt it again. Because then, you know, your body adjusts to like the certain milligram strength that you're on. You know, gradually it starts to accept that this is the new norm. But then when I got into the every other day, the body was like, well, hold up. You're starving me now? I thought you were just giving me less. And so those days without it initially weren't horrible like they once, or like they certainly could have been, but they were definitely noticeable up until the last few weeks, and the body started like adjust to like, okay, this is what it's like when we're doing it every other day. And then I would say that the first week after taking that last pill, again, that was a noticeable difference, but it just, that awareness is a huge part of that process. That like these feelings I'm feeling, the tingling in my lips, or the slight panic, or like the the difficulty breathing is the anxiety. Where in the past, there wasn't even a recognition of what anxiety was. So when I felt these feelings, it's just the body's fight or flight kicking in, like, we're dying, we're suffering. And then you panic about the panic, and then the panic panics you panic. Whatever, you get what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, stress. Stress begets stress begets stress. And the body handles stress in pretty strange ways sometimes. Pretty gruesome, brutal ways sometimes. But the simple awareness that it's okay, David, what you're feeling right now isn't a permanent thing. You are feeling symptoms of withdrawals. And then when the withdrawal acknowledgement kind of sunk in, then it was like, oh, this is what anxiety is. Let's take those lessons we've learned and just breathe. Just reflect in it. Anxiety is just a thing that we go through. It does not need to be the thing that kills us. It can be helpful in a way, like, because it when you feel anxious, it sort of mandates that you either panic or reflect. Why am I anxious? Why am I feeling this? Oh, did I eat like shit yesterday and I'm actually just feeling stomach pain and I'm panicking about the stomach pain? Is there something going on in my life? Have I been sleeping well? And again, both internal and external, like, what are some stressful things in my life that I have been doing? Have I been working a lot? Have I not been focusing on X, Y, or Z? Well, let's start to focus on that. But also, breathe. It's okay. You are okay. You are not dying. And again, at its worst, I actually thought sometimes I was dying. Because panic attacks for me felt like, or were initially triggered by what I imagine, or the closest thing I can imagine to what like a heart attack felt like. I thought I was having heart attacks. Well, a heart attack until it's over. When you're over, you're like, oh, if this was a heart attack, I probably would have just died. So then it's over and then you feel like a fool and you're like, oh, that was a panic attack or whatever. But anyways, so now I'm about 3 weeks in, maybe even upwards of a month, of being off of it in general. I don't think I'm going to cry here, but I probably could if I really allowed myself to do it, but I probably need to see straight. I think for the first time in my life, that's not true, but for one of the rare times in my life, I think I can say that I am honestly extremely proud of myself for how I have handled myself since being off of the medication. Look, I definitely have issues with depression that I still really need to work on. There's a ton of self-loathing. There is a ton of self-doubt. There's a ton of fear about what my life will ultimately end up being like. But the awareness that I am not my thoughts, that I can choose the way that I think about things, even though the reality around me is sometimes extraordinarily difficult, I have come to some conclusions, while even though I fail to acknowledge this sometimes, yeah, that simple, like, I am not my thoughts is such a big point of growth for me, that in the past I was like, I'm doomed to think about it like this. If I hate myself, I'm always going to hate myself. And while I can't necessarily say that I've gotten to a point where I love myself, I'm working on it. And that's huge for me. That was me not spending a lot of time on talking about the anxiety medication. Let's talk about some things. I reached out on both Threads, which I am now a part of in the podcast sets. First of all, it's at David J. Mund if you use Threads, the Instagram/Facebook counter or answer to Twitter or X. Look, it's not perfect, but it's certainly a much more enjoyable place there than it was on Twitter back in the day. I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been on there in some time. I hear it's a bit wild. But I posed the question on Threads, Facebook, and Instagram, all on the ADH Deep Dive or ADH Deep Dive podcast platform or channel page, whatever the hell you call it on all of those platforms. I just said, whether it's, you know, whether it's drugs or alcohol or even just biting your fingernails, what are some things that you are addicted to? Or what are addictions that you struggle with to this day? And I had a few, but I want to touch on three in specific only because they're common, worth talking about, and one of them in particular, well, maybe even two of them in particular, I think people don't really allow themselves to believe that they struggle with, because again, like I mentioned kind of near the front of this, you don't have to be an alcoholic to be an addict. You don't have to be addicted to heroin to be an addict. Addictions come in many forms. And it doesn't mean you are an addict. You don't have to label yourself as an addict, I suppose. But it is naive to believe that you can only be addicted to drugs. Let's talk about a few of them, shall we? Let's start with the most gentle of them. Actually, I was just about to out who these people were. So rude of me. I can't believe I almost did that. We'll start with the first. Being a more gentle one, but I think it was posed as caffeine in general. They said, now, I could, I guess, read this verbatim, but that would require me pulling up the responses on my phone, and I'm already being wildly irresponsible just driving with one hand and holding a camera in the other, or holding a microphone in the other. So the first one being, yeah, caffeine. Maybe they said soda. But anyway, the general part of it was caffeine. So in my own life, I don't know that I've struggled with the addiction of caffeine, as in, like, if I am without it, I suffer. I definitely find it to be a thing that I enjoy when I have it. A, because I like coffee. I love espresso. But, you know, there's plenty of new drinks out there. That, first of all, some people take caffeine supplements. Celsius is a big one out right now. Not a supplement, it's a drink. But, like, you know, I never drank any Monster or Red Bull or anything like that, mostly because I always found those tastes to be nuclear. Like, it felt like toxic waste, toxic sludge. And whatever, maybe I'm just a friggin' hipster at heart, but they always felt really trendy, especially growing up. Maybe they're not now. I don't know. I think I just saw a text pop up on my screen that I'm not going to respond to, and I'm not even going to look at in full because, again, I am driving. Also, I am sorry if you are watching the video version how out of focus this might be. Initially, I was going to run this with manual focus, so it just stayed where it was, but sometimes the focus slips in that way, and I didn't want, especially when it's leaning up against, I mean, you're sitting on a freaking blanket resting up against a pillow right now so that it stays relatively still, and I just didn't want the focus to slip a little bit, so I just put it on autofocus, and then I have the little square tapped onto my face. I just looked over, and it was slipping back and forth. So if you enjoy the audio version, I'm very sorry, or the video version, I'm very sorry that, like, whatever, you get it. You get it. What the fuck was I talking about? Anyways, Red Bulls and Monsters wasn't really my thing. And I am not, I don't actually enjoy, like, a late in the afternoon caffeine, because I've always noticed that, like, caffeine actually does the job for me. And if I have it too late in the day, I cannot fall asleep. So much so that, like, I noticed the actual effects of the caffeine. Like, there is this, like, physical exhaustion, but the mind is just going and going and going, and it's sort of impossible to fall asleep. That's the worst to me. And I actually hear a lot of people who are like, oh, I slept like shit last night. Nice. You drink caffeine at fucking 10 at night. And they're like, well, caffeine doesn't really work for me. Yeah, it does. You're just addicted to it. Own it. All right? So what I do now is I have my coffee in the morning. And I only end up drinking about half of my cup of coffee, because by the time I get about halfway through, here comes the poo. And then at that point, usually I've got things to do. So I'm awake enough to start doing my yoga or make my breakfast or whatever. And then occasionally throughout the day, you know, if it's before 2 in the afternoon, I'll get like a shot of espresso or something like that. I don't usually do much more coffee, mainly because coffee seems to have a more harsh effect on my bowels than espresso does. But like, I've had a Celsius before. I've only had 2 Celsius drinks. My understanding is that those have about 200 milligrams of caffeine in it. And the one that I really like is the one that's like an orange marshmallow. It kind of tastes like a creamsicle or whatever. Or citrus marshmallow, and then it tastes like one of those orange creamsicles. And I get about halfway through one of those if I'm midday, and I felt my heart freaking pumping out of my chest. So when you get into those high milligram strength caffeine drinks, like I can't really do those. And again, just to be clear, this is not an advice podcast. This is not a self-help podcast. So I don't really have advice on how to kick caffeine addiction, other than what I imagine is probably the best way to kick any addiction: a gradual weaning off of the drug of choice or the vice of choice. Maybe there are some drugs where it's way more important to just get off of them. But again, I am not a physician nor a psychologist or a therapist. I'm just here to talk about shit. And caffeine is one of those like socially accepted addictions that, again, if any of these addictions apply to you, I just want you to think back to supply chain issues, natural disasters. What would your life be like if suddenly tomorrow you could no longer partake in the vice that you are addicted to? You would probably be in a pretty rough spot. So why allow yourself to be controlled by any vice, knowing full well that if that vice went away tomorrow, you'd be suffering? Kick your addictions today. Today is the first day of the rest of your life, people. Go from 10 cups of coffee down to 5, then down to 2, then down to 1, and then you poo. Okay, that was enough for coffee. Now, what order do I want to talk about these next two? Because, again, one of these ones, again, I'm actually going to, this is not a holier-than-thou position I'm taking, because I certainly partook in this vice. But it's one of those ones that people find themselves pretty uncomfortable talking about, that I don't think is really that weird to talk about in 2024. But one of the ones that we end up hiding from people, especially if you are chronically addicted to it, which, again, I'm not coming at this from a holier-than-thou position, because I used to partake in it, but I have actually made a conscious decision to no longer partake in it for some reasons I'm sure that we'll get into. Porn. Yeah, I said it. Porn. I do not have the statistics on what percentage of Americans engage in or partake in consumption of porn. But I do know that it is many, many more than it ever was, many more now than it ever was, or much higher than it ever was, because we live in the digital age. And maybe we'll back up a little bit. I'm not going to really, to a large degree, talk about what it is people do when partaking in or engaging in porn, because I think we all know. Unless you are one of those people who just looks at it just to look, which I want to be careful in the way that I talk about it. I do think that's a problem. I am not coming at this from a religious perspective, or even necessarily a moral perspective, although there is an element of that that maybe we'll touch on. I'm not a therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a doctor. You know, I'm not none of these things. Simply a humble bald man. But we live in an era where porn is just a click away. And once upon a time, you used to have to sneakily steal it or find it from your friend's parents who were hiding it above their washer and dryer in a false cupboard in their laundry room. That was the first time I ever found porn. I was at a buddy's house, and he was like, yo, check this out. I had to be like maybe 10, maybe 11, something like that. Maybe even younger than that, which is kind of sad if I think about it. If I was younger than that, I mean, even at that age, it's just you're a baby and you should not be partaking in that. And it really sours your view of just sex in general going forward. I'm really trying to approach. I'm talking about this in an approachable way. I don't think these stutters are from uncomfortability. More just I want to talk about it in a sensitive way because I think it's a real issue. Well, it can be a real issue. But anyways, yeah, my friend was like, check this out, and we went. Their parents like went to the gas station or whatever, the grocery store that was close enough nearby that, you know, this was the early 2000s, kids that were born in the mid to late 90s, I guess early 90s. Yeah, 94, baby. Anyways, it was a different time. I don't think people typically leave their 10-year-olds home alone, but it was not uncommon to be left home alone at 10 years old back in the day. Anyways, he brings me into the washroom, the laundry room. And he gets up on top of the dryer, and then there's like this cupboard above the dryer, and then on top of the cupboard, there's like a foot space between the top of that cupboard, I guess it's a cabinet, and the ceiling, and it looks like it's just flat, but there's like a small 2 to 3 inch divot on the flat surface of the cabinet, and within that, there was a piece of wood placed on top of it, so it looked like there was no flat spot. And underneath that piece of wood was porn. It was probably Playboy magazines. There were more brands than that, or more publications than just Playboy back in the day. I'm sure, but I'm pretty sure it was Playboy. And if not, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But that was when I saw my first porn. I don't know if I had seen in a sexual way naked women, but I certainly had never seen sex before, other than, you know, maybe we had gotten that like health class school public education based sex talk, I don't know, in which they probably showed us female parts and male parts, but we weren't seeing penetrative sex. That's for sure. And I certainly wasn't seeing two ladies making out, which I know I definitely saw back then because that was very exciting to me. that was definitely the first time I'd ever seen anything like that, which again, I feel is way too young to see. But now it's possible that you're freaking 7 and 8 year olds are looking at porn because if they have unfettered access to the internet, because it's that easy to look at. You don't have to pay for porn. You don't have to secretly order porn. And even beyond porn in like its traditional sense, again, let's use the penetrative sex version of porn, it's really easy to just Google image search naked, you know, in my case, naked women. And now it's becoming more, like, sex work in general is becoming more socially acceptable. Which, again, I want to be very clear here that, like, this is for this is totally for another discussion. I have no interest in really engaging in justifying my answer here. But I do believe that there needs to be a loosening or a relaxing of sex work laws in this country. I believe that legalizing sex work leads to a more regulatory stance, which gets us into, you know, safe sex practices, which can eliminate portions of human trafficking or non-consensual sex work. Maybe I'm digging a hole that I don't really feel like getting into. I just mean, whatever. We're going to get away from the sex work side of it. We're just going to talk about porn in its traditional sense. Looking at naked people for sexual purposes, for sexual pleasure. And again, okay, let me explain my adult view of this, in that, yeah, that was the first time I ever looked at it. I was a kid, and from then on, I would try to steal those things, or at least borrow them. We're not talking about the whys, because we all understand the whys. Grow up, right? Grow up. But more importantly, on a fundamental level, a reason I no longer engage in just looking at porn, it's just sort of the psychological damage that it can do to a person in a relationship. Now, I think that people can have a healthy relationship with porn viewership. I'm really coming at this with some blunt terms here, so I'm sorry for the casualness in which I am speaking of this, but let me hit you with an abrupt one. You know, why can't I say what I'm trying to say here? I'm just trying to find a not PC way, just an acceptable way. There is tasteful nudes. Let's go with that. Okay, yeah. There are tasteful nudes where a person who is really proud of their body or thinks that they are capable of arousing someone sexually just takes pictures of themselves or has pictures taken of themselves in just their nude form. The human body is to be loved and appreciated. I think there is nothing wrong with tasteful nudity in films and television and photography and art in general. There's nothing wrong with that. Even the act of making love, having sex, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a dirty thing. And I don't even think necessarily, I don't think looking at porn means you're fucked up. First of all, because I'm gonna bet that most of you listening have at one point or another, certainly not all of you. In fact, I don't know that for sure, but I'm sure most of us, most of you, have looked at porn in some capacity before. Doesn't mean a lot, doesn't mean often, doesn't mean more than once. It just means before. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Where it becomes an issue for me, and I don't think it became an issue for me, but becomes an issue for people, is when the idea of just having sex with your partner, the idea of that is not enough. Like, you know, some people like long for more. I think it just gives a false impression, certainly for young viewers, But for many people in general, it just gives a false impression of what sex is or should be. This is a subjective view. Again, I've beat this dead horse. I've beat this horse to death is what I'm trying to say. But I don't know. I really do want to be delicate for some reason in the way that I talk about it, because I don't want anyone to feel as though I am coming for them, that I am attacking the way that they live their life. If you don't think you have a problem, so be it. I am not here to declare that you have a problem. I know that it can be a problem for people who look at porn every single day to see the new positions and the new moves and the new toys and the new ideas and the new kinks and the new views of relationship and polyamory and whatever, that can plant such a false idea of what love and sex actually are, that by the time they are allowed to engage in sex with a person, namely a monogamous partner, that if you're addicted to the positions and the views and the this and the that, that like it can ruin that libido. It can ruin your interest in your partner sexually. And I think that's an issue, especially when you're in a committed monogamous relationship and sex is a part of that relationship. But beyond that, man, there is so much porn out there that, again, I'm really not trying to judge here, just my personal subjective view, that like there's so many fucked up categories and fucked up views and settings and storylines about, like, you know, whatever. I really feel weird, maybe not weird, but uneasy trying to talk about the stuff that I am made uneasy by without feeling like I'm attacking anybody else. But like, let's go with the most well-known, I guess. There's a thing called the casting couch, which is just a plot line where a woman comes into a room and is essentially like auditioning for a job. And then they go, okay, well, it looks like your qualifications check out, but there's one more thing we want to see if you can do. And in order to get the job, you have to fuck this person or pleasure them sexually in whatever way. And even if every single person involved in these videos is participating in it consensually, the view of that particular genre is that, like, women always have to be ready to serve and pleasure and let go of the fact that they're made uncomfortable by a particular situation because someday some man is going to want to have sex with them and they need to be ready at any moment. That is the most casual PG one I could talk about. Certainly, there are just so many other versions of, yeah, that. That, like, it's just, whatever. Okay, all right. It ain't for me. It certainly was up until probably, you know, recently, too. I mean, and again, this is not a holier-than-thou take. I'm sure that, like, maybe this is where it gets uncomfortable to talk about, but, like, I'm sure that I have been made aroused by images of sexy girls. But I am not in any way seeking out categories or videos or specific content creators, so much so that, like, you know, because it sort of like allows you to think that you have, like, that sex can be custom curated in a relationship, that, like, well, today I want this. Today I want to look at this. That by the time that you are in a monogamous relationship where, let's be honest, the most famous position, missionary sex, that becomes so like, ugh, really? That's boring. When, to be quite honest with you, okay, I'll drop it. We're done with the porn part. I can't believe we talked about porn for 25 minutes. That's all I gotta say. that's somebody's addiction. I'm actually very grateful that they were honest, because I can see who submit that. I will not out them. It is not relevant to say who made that as a submission. But it's a good topic of conversation, because some people think that, like, there's nothing wrong with it. Which, again, I guess subjectively, maybe there's not. And the most important part about it is that you just need to make sure that this is all consensual from the ground up. Certainly, you have given yourself consent if you open up that browser and type it in. But, like, I don't think many people do the research to make sure that participants in this were not forced to participate in sex, or that even at its most extreme, that any of this result was a result of human trafficking. That shit's scary. It's dark. It is a dark underbelly of the porn industry that people don't really want to think about, because all they want to do is knock one loose. And that is enough of a reason for me to be like, nah, it ain't for me. And if anything, whatever, we're done here. Okay. I think this is maybe... I'm glad that I did it in this order, from caffeine to porn to this one, because I think this is where we'll go out. Because I think this is relevant to addictions and anxiety and depression in general. All things that we've talked about here. Someone responded that they are addicted to their codependency. And let me tell you, I really, really relate to that one, or have related to that. And, you know, maybe one day we'll find out that I no longer relate to, but I have to imagine I probably do relate to them in a big way. Codependency in relationships. I've discussed many times here how insufferable I can be, especially in a relationship. And just in blunt terms, I've been engaged thrice, married once, divorced once, and then in my most recent relationship, right after proposing, which was something that was asked of me, something that I kind of explicitly said, I don't think I can do, especially post-divorce. I don't think that I can get engaged again, because it's just the idea felt so publicly humiliating. Like, okay, this guy's getting engaged again. But I was led to believe by this person who kind of, like, begged me that, like, well, it'll be different this time. And then 2 weeks later, I found out they were cheating on me. And it fucking destroyed me. And I've been single since, intentionally. I would love to one day be in a relationship. I don't think that time is now. I don't know. I'm more open to the idea now than I ever have been, or than I have been in the last 3 years. But my codependency in relationships is a reason for why I'm single. You know, yes, this person cheated on me. And I gotta be honest, that one hurt worse than any relationship or breakup I've ever been a part of. Tenfold. No question. That does not mean that I was perfect. So much so that my codependency probably was, not to excuse their behavior, probably was one of the leading reasons for why they were like, oh, I gotta find somebody else. This guy sucks. But also, don't, like, beg me to marry you in the meantime. Anyways, many people, including myself in the past, get into relationships not because they love the person that they're with, but because they believe if they do not settle down with this person or get with them in a relationship or label themselves in a relationship, that they will be alone and miserable forever. Codependency, in my view, or in my experience, is the result of a lack of self-love. Partners in a relationship need to be able to depend on each other. Yes, certainly. That, like, you need to be able to trust your partner. You need to be able to rely on them not to betray you or hurt you. Even though we all make mistakes, and you certainly will, especially if you're in a long-term relationship, you are going to fail. You are going to hurt your partner's feelings. That does not mean you are a bad partner. It just means that we're all human, and it happens. But desperately needing your partner to save you is toxic codependency. I hated myself so much, especially while in relationships, that, like, my view is like, I need you to stay with me, not because I love you, but because if you leave me, I'm alone, and I hate being alone. Which is why I believe it was so important for me after this relationship where I was cheated on. It was so important for me to spend the last few years alone, because maybe this is a trope or a cliche phrase or whatever, but you cannot truly love someone. What's the word? Not unequivocally. Unconditionally. You cannot truly love someone unconditionally without first learning to love yourself. Because self-love requires self-forgiveness. And self-forgiveness, and forgiveness of others, requires the ability to recognize just what I said, that we are all human and that we all do make mistakes. So in the most lax of terms, if this person didn't cheat on me, but instead they, in the first year of us being together, forgot my birthday, that doesn't mean that I am not worth love and that they hate me and that they actually secretly have been plotting to destroy my life from day one. It just means that they forgot. I am hurt by that. And I think maybe you can be allowed to hurt by that. Like, it is okay to be hurt if someone hurts your feelings. But to take simple mistakes and conflate them as personal attacks in a relationship is an element of codependency. That, like, I've put so much stock in this one person that I have gaslit myself into believing that, A, they cannot harm me, they never will, and they would never even think about it. They are not capable of harming me. And then on the flip side, if they do accidentally hurt me, that means they never loved me, and they never cared about me. And I've been right from day one that this has all just been a pity party just for me, because you're not, the only reason you're still with me is because you would hate the optics of what it would look like if you broke up with me. And you don't want to be the person to break up with me, so that's the only reason you're staying with me. You want me to break up with you, but I'm not going to do it because I love you so much and you hate me. Insufferable. Selfish. Not intentionally, but it is selfish to believe that a person cannot make mistakes, and that if they do make mistakes, that it is a personal attack on you. Codependency is toxic, and it is an addiction. And similar to what I said earlier, which again is just a cliche thing, this is not a unique thought, this is not a unique idea, you are not your thoughts. I am not my thoughts. We are not our thoughts. You can get yourself to a point, and even if I'm not there yet, I still believe this, we can get ourselves to a point where we don't rely on our vices. We are not controlled by our vices in the same way that we are not controlled by our thoughts. And that if we do have these thoughts, we can have new thoughts and change thoughts. So in a more healthy view in a relationship, not like you hurt me, therefore you've always hated me. It can just be you hurt me and that really hurt. And I'm going to express this to you in a calm, measured way so that I know that I get the point across, but I also don't hurt you in the process. Because that's sort of the problem, is that when we feel as though we've been personally attacked, we then go into defense mode and we hurt our partners who we claim to love, that we're like, you said you'd never hurt me. Therefore, I'm going to hurt you worse than you ever hurt me. Well, that's pretty much living proof that people do make mistakes, huh? And that you can hurt someone that you love, even if you don't intend to, right? Right. We did it. We did it, guys. I got 10 minutes left on my drive. Again, I'm spending the weekend shooting 3 music videos. And Saturday, I'm directing a crowd of probably about 50 people. And I am stressed the fuck out about that. And let me tell you, you know what would really relieve some of that stress? Weed. Probably also anxiety medication. But I also recognize that it is, and even if I don't know that for sure yet, it simply must be. Let me back up. I, even if I am not 100% sure, I must be enough. I must be able to get through this without vices or being dependent on others. Sober David is capable, competent, growing in his confidence, but also capable of making mistakes, but also worthy of forgiveness if he does. And that's got to be enough. And again, even if I don't always believe that to be 100% true, that's too bad. I simply must. Because right now, I don't really have any other choice other than to give in to my vices and give in to my addictions and allow myself to be controlled by something other than myself. I am in control of the way that I handle situations. I am in control of the way that I respond to situations. And I am not my thoughts. So if along the way I go, wow, David, you suck, I just think that in the moment. I don't suck. Right? Right. Okay. Well, with that. 420, baby! Blaze it! On April 20th, come see Midwest Skies in downtown Grand Rapids. Go to MidwestSkiesRock.com for more information. And then on April 27th, I'll be back up here in Kalkaska, the Traverse City area, for Troutzilla Fest. Midwest Skies has an hour-long set. And on both of these shows, we are going to be playing a song that I wrote about 10 years ago in riff form, and maybe about a year and a half ago in lyric form, that I just could not be more proud of. I'm so happy that we are finally getting to a point where that song can approach its, not just debut, but its release publicly. So, and then if you'd like, head to the Patreon. You know, at minimum, just become a, if you're interested, become a $1 a month patron. I would greatly appreciate that. It helps support the show, these creative endeavors. And in theory, the hope is to, at the very least, release this podcast a day early so that Patreon members, patrons, get to see it first. And then, if this becomes kind of a sustainable business model, There can be extra goodies for the patron members, for the Patreon subscribers, the patrons. All right. I am approaching my destination. I love you so much. I think that was a good episode. Way better than talking about shit coming out of my butt like I did last week or the week before. Whatever. Last episode. If you made it this far, you rock. I love you. And I will see you next time.